Hey, social butterflies. Thanks for joining us on The Forum, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy, where science comes to socialize. I'm Daniela, and here with me I have my two co-hosts, Aubrey and Cleo.
Hey, everyone.
Welcome back.
Today we'll be chatting about one of the topics that gets me most heated, Western dietary patterns and their effects on public health.
Right. If you've ever spent some time with Daniela, getting her started on this topic leads to a dangerously never-ending rant.
That's true, but I'm passionate because it's seriously such an important issue. Believe it or not, diseases prevalent in Western societies are some of the most serious threats to public health today, and I don't think enough people are talking about it.
I'm right there with you, Dee, and that's why today's episode is super relevant to society. Hopefully starting that conversation will help us all make more informed decisions in our everyday lives.
So today, we'll be chatting about Dr. Stephen O'Keefe's policy position paper titled Diet and Colon Cancer Risk. Dr. O'Keefe is a professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Nutrition at the University of Pittsburgh, and this paper here was debated at the ISGP's 2015 conference, Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Food Security and Diet-Linked Public Health Challenges, held in Fargo, North Dakota, in collaboration with North Dakota State University, of course.
But before jumping into today's debate, let's remind our listeners to communicate with us during and after listening to today's podcast. Reach us on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook if you prefer, and remember to tag your posts with the hashtag ISGP Forum.
All right, so now let's dive right in and give you an overview of the biggest issues surrounding Western dietary patterns and public health. Dee, would you like to do the honors and start us off?
Sure thing. So first of all, let's all be clear that Western dietary patterns have detrimental health effects ranging far and wide. Take risk of cardiovascular disease, for instance. But today, we'll be focusing specifically on the influence of Western diets on colon cancer risk. This disease is super interesting to observe geographically because it's more common in more affluent countries and rare in less affluent countries. It's one of the so-called Westernized diseases.
Right. Studies looking at immigrants have provided strong evidence suggesting that the disease results from factors in a person's surrounding environment. Wait, now don't look at me funny, guys. I'll explain. These studies show that when examining a migrant population that originated in an area of low colon cancer risk, but that migrated to a country with high colon cancer risk, it only takes one generation for that population to become high risk.
Based on the analysis of epidemiological surveys around the world, Sir Richard Dahl and his colleague Sir Richard Peto at Oxford University concluded that diet was the responsible environmental factor in more than 90% of gastroenterological cancer cases.
And for those of you that are not familiar, gastroenterological cancer is just a fancy way of referring to a cancer that exists in the areas of your body responsible for processes of digestion. So colon cancer would definitely apply here.
In the United States, colon cancer is the third most common cancer afflicting both men and women, and, perhaps more importantly, it's the second leading cause of cancer-related death for both sexes.
African Americans bear the brunt of the disease in the U.S. The rate of colon cancer in men from 2002 to 2004 was 61.4 for every 100,000 white men versus 72.9 for every 100,000 black men. And for those of you whose talents do not include mental math when listening to a radio show, like myself, that's a difference of 11.5 men per 100,000.
And in women, the rate of colon cancer was 44.7 for every 100,000 white women and 56.1 for every 100,000 black women. The difference here is pretty similar to the one Cleo just mentioned, 11.4 per 100,000.
And in a very interesting comparison, Alaskan Native people have the highest recorded rate of colon cancer in the world, at more than 100 cases for every 100,000 people. In contrast, rural Native Africans rarely get this cancer, with an incidence of less than 5 for every 100,000.
And now that we've blown your mind, or melted your brain with a million numbers...
Right, back to the qualitative, at least for a sentence or two. Westernization or modernization seems to be a bit controversial in its ability to improve human life. Westernization has been associated with a dramatic increase in expected lifespan from less than 25 years before the Industrial Revolution to 78.9 years in the US today. Sorry, more numbers there.
And that's a remarkable statistic. Let's just stop and think about what Cleo just said for a second. A 25-year lifespan extended to nearly 80 years. This change cannot be attributed to genetic evolution, but it can be attributed to the remarkable ability of humans to adapt to their environments. The dramatic increases in food production generated by the combined forces of the agricultural and industrial revolutions resulted in increased individual purchasing power that ultimately led to increases in the diversity of the human gene pool.
And this further resulted in improved standards of living, societal development, additional time and facilities for experimentation and entrepreneurship, and ultimately the modern scientific era. It's this sequence of events that's been responsible for absolutely critical advances in sanitation, housing, vaccination, antibiotics, medical care, and political diplomacy, all of which have helped increase life expectancy. Think about it. Today, for the most part, we have a pretty solid ability, or at least understanding, to avoid life-threatening events such as prenatal complications, acute infections, trauma, and according to Dr. O'Keefe, even war.
That said, we're now looking at the other side of the story, where the quality of the lives we get to live with this expanded lifespan has been tarnished by these westernized diseases, like colon cancer.
These westernized diseases are the biggest contributors to death and disability in the world. In 2005, at least 35 million people of all ages, nationalities, and socioeconomic levels died from heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes, respiratory disease, and other chronic illnesses.
And the figures are unfortunately even higher today.
And continuing to increase.
Right. For example, it's been estimated that by 2030, there could be up to 26.8 million new cases of cancer and 17.1 million cancer deaths every year, as well as 80 million total people living with cancer within 5 years of diagnosis. In other words, in 2030, there will be 80 million people out there that will find out they have cancer within the following 5 years.
While cancer is currently rare in African countries, there is a huge concern that rates will soar with progressive westernization, which is already occurring in certain cities such as Harare, Zimbabwe. And although some argue that these diseases are a consequence of lengthening lifespans, studies of hunter-gatherers have shown that members of these communities of our past were spared these diseases in old age.
Okay, so aren't diet and colon cancer linked? That would make sense, since westernization often implies new dietary trends. Can we go over this, please?
All right, sure. Recent advances in genetics, microbiology, analytical chemistry, and systems biology have revealed an extraordinarily high level of mutualism, or beneficial cooperation, between our species and the microorganisms that live in and on us. These make up the microbiome, which you might have heard of before. This mutualism could explain the strong association between diet and colon cancer, and it might also explain the manifestation of other diseases prevalent in Western societies, such as obesity, atherosclerosis, and diabetes.
Right. And the challenge then becomes defining the ideal diet. With regard to the colon, it's likely that there's an ideal microbiome that evolved along with the human diet and digestive tract. There is good evidence that this cooperative relationship has been lost with westernization and that there hasn't been enough time for us to genetically adapt to sumptuous modern diets.
So, it's likely that our health would be better maintained by the diet adopted by Homo sapiens in the Paleolithic era in Africa, a period that lasted from about 2.5 million to 11,000 years ago.
And some fascinating insight into the composition of this quote, ideal diet has been gained by analysis of coprolite from prehistoric deposits in caves in southwest Arizona dating back 14,000 years. Namely, these analyses suggest that complex carbohydrates and fiber dominated the diet.
For those of you not familiar with, everyday archaeological terms, coprolite analysis is just a fancy way of saying the analysis of ancient human feces to determine consumption patterns.
Thanks, Steve, for that visual. Maybe we should have just let people Google that one. Anyway, diseases ascribed to a Western diet tend to be attributed to its low content of fresh fruits, vegetables, and unrefined grains, coupled with an excess of meat and terrestrial fat. This has been supported by epidemiological surveys from around the globe, experimental studies, and most recently by studies involving humans, which showed, get this, colon cancer risk decreased within 2 weeks of changing the diet to one that's high in fiber and low in fat.
Now that we've depressed everyone with some sobering statistics and told them that their diets are cause for their demise, do you think we can save the mood?
Challenge accepted. Let's talk strategies for moving forward.
What we do best, you mean? Gladly. So, obviously the key point here is that efforts to increase the intake of fruits, vegetables, and unrefined grains, and to reduce terrestrial fat consumption, will ultimately reduce the incidence of and mortality associated with colon cancer in westernized communities all around the world.
Right. Debaters agree that given this strong link between the proliferation of colon cancer biomarkers and the consumption of a westernized diet, and the compelling scientific evidence that changing to a high-fiber, low-fat diet rapidly decreases the number of such biomarkers within the colon and improves overall colon health, policies are needed that promote increased consumption of high-fiber food, things like fresh fruits and vegetables.
Right. But can we really change someone's diet? I mean, changing these kinds of personal behaviors like smoking or drinking, that's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there are some pretty graphic anti-smoking ads out there, and my uncle still smokes every day. Yes, this is me calling you out, Uncle John.
Yeah, Uncle John. Jeez, quit already. Anyway, all that is true. Many do claim that changing these types of behaviors is impossible. But although governmental regulation restricting diets in the public is not acceptable in a free society, debaters did agree that governments need to encourage the adoption of healthier eating habits. They urged that the application of evidence-based health strategies addressing urban planning, education, agricultural policy, and health systems development has been shown to be effective.
And these strategies have to have adaptations or interventions relevant to different levels of society. We're talking national, regional, and local.
As an example, the application of evidence-based health strategies has proven robust and successful in reducing both cigarette smoking and physical inactivity.
That is true, which is exciting. But we have to recognize that while these approaches have proven effective in Western societies, they haven't been in less affluent countries where supporting infrastructure is missing.
Right. Actually, the debaters urge that these approaches ensure that such foods are affordable and obtainable, especially in low-income and rural communities that may currently have access only to less nutritious options.
But that's not to say that we shouldn't remain hopeful about these successful examples. But it does reinforce the idea that evidence-based health strategies have to be adapted to fit the context of the area of implementation. Strategies can be divided into local options and national/international public health programs.
All right, so why don't we start teasing out possible local strategies?
Well, for one, it is crucial to promote the consumption of fresh fruits, salads, and vegetables in school cafeterias, workplaces, urban and rural cafes, and restaurants.
Oh, absolutely. I remember growing up with a school cafeteria where I basically had a choice between greasy tater tots or a slice of pizza and chocolate milk. And man, those cookies in high school were amazing before I had to stop eating gluten. Replacing unhealthy foods in school cafeterias with more choices of fruits, vegetables, and coarse grains is super necessary. We have to apply restrictions to fried and fatty foods.
And this could be implemented alongside educational programs for children and adults to learn the dangers of overeating and obesity, and the need to combine good eating habits with frequent exercise.
So it's funny you mention this, because the debaters actually loved the idea of raising public awareness of the preventive benefits of a high-fiber diet. And they said we could do this by developing effective educational programs that inform consumers about the human microbiome, as well as its relationship to the development of disease and its susceptibility to dietary influences. These educational programs could encourage healthier food choices through robust marketing strategies similar to those used by the food industry, and discourage unhealthy diets by realistically portraying the consequences of those diets.
Although any hampering of the food industry's freedom is quite difficult to achieve, a potentially very effective local strategy is to ban the advertising of unbalanced calorie-rich fast foods on TV and other public media, and instead promote balanced diets and healthy eating.
And promoting these diets could be done by advertising the benefits of, once again, a balanced diet as well as physical activity and a healthy lifestyle when it comes to promoting good health and longevity.
And promotion of a balanced diet doesn't only have to occur via media, but it can also be provided right where the consumer makes their dietary choices, at supermarkets. Nutrition education should occur at supermarkets, and appropriate information about the nutrient content of foods needs to be provided. In addition, healthier foods and beverages should be introduced in local, more remote stores.
Oh, on that topic, let me share a quick fun fact or story with you. While I was back in Chile for the holidays, I decided to accompany my mom to the supermarket. You should have seen my face as we walked through the aisles. I was like a kid in a candy store. The Chilean Ministry of Health recently passed legislation saying that every single product must have a government label on the front of the package warning if the product is high in fats, sugars, calories, carbohydrates, or sodium. Each of these categories gets its own stop sign-shaped warning, indirectly incentivizing manufacturers to decrease the number of stop signs on their products by producing healthier foods. I was so excited picking everything up and finding out the real truth.
Only Daniela would be excited seeing the unhealthiness of some of her favorite foods plastered in front of her face. Well, although this seems to be a mixture of local and national strategies, it's definitely a good example of an evidence-based health strategy. Thanks for sharing, Dee.
Yeah, that is super exciting that the Ministry of Health is taking such initiative. In any case, to finish off the other local strategies, community gardens that grow vegetables and fruits should be supported by the community, and farmers markets must be made available to urban communities to provide easier access to these high-fiber foods.
Now, let's see if we can expand on these local strategies by looking at what we can implement on a national and even international level.
Alrighty, a good example of a mixture between a local and national public health program is the promotion of, quote, health in all policies. This really is as straightforward as it sounds. It's a school of thought that supports public policy and governmental interventions that change both the environment and individual behaviors to promote health and prevent chronic disease throughout society.
So this is actually relevant when it comes to establishing a national strategy to regulate food advertising and marketing to children and adults that emphasizes balanced diets. Authorities in charge of social marketing and advertising regulation would have to consider health in order for this strategy to get off the ground.
Another controversial national policy option is to tax low-fiber, fatty foods and snacks. Many think that this isn't feasible, but supporters cite the example of strategies used to reduce cigarette smoking.
The introduction of such a tax would mean that the national government was motivated to take action, right? Well, this leads to our next point, which is that dietary intervention projects must be transferred ownership-wise to national health authorities. Population-based cancer preventive strategies are remarkably cost-effective because increasing population health is also a way to ensure that people can keep working and purchasing and otherwise stimulating the economy.
Dee, the example you gave us of the Chilean Ministry of Health ties really well into this point. The fact that the labels are administered by the government gives them legitimacy and increases trust, compared to labels claiming that a food is nutritious but that are administered by the producing company itself, these government labels ensure that the labels themselves are not merely marketing strategies.
National leadership, such as Chile's, is required to place the eradication of westernized diseases high on national agendas. Going off of this example, Dr. O'Keefe argues that the National Institutes of Health should be funding studies designed to reduce Western diseases.
That's not to say, though, that all supporting and funding should necessarily come from national institutes. International organizations, such as the World Health Organization, or WHO, should help to promote national capacity building to eradicate westernized diseases as well.
It should be noted that the portion of the WHO 2006 to 2007 budget devoted to the non-communicable diseases accounted for just 12% of their total budget.
Right. Meanwhile, a huge 86% of WHO funds in the Western Pacific region were applied to combating infectious diseases, despite the fact that these pathologies are only responsible for 14% of the mortality burden there.
In order to address priority discrepancies between funding and actual real-world needs related to public health, Dr. O'Keefe urges that the international community must forge a common mission between national healthcare organizations through workshops and close networking. Funding for these activities could be obtained through U.S. government international cooperation initiatives, as well as World Cancer Research Societies, the WHO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and even the Gates Foundation.
So, to recap real quick and make sure we're all on the same page, there is convincing experimental and human study evidence that the Western diet, which is rich in red meat and animal fat and deficient in fiber, drives westernized diseases such as colon cancer.
But to add on to our discussion, there are unfortunately plenty more westernized diseases where colon cancer comes from, for lack of better terms. We're talking about various allergies, autoimmune diseases, osteoarthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, I'm going to keep going here, obesity, diabetes, osteoporosis, hypertension, coronary heart disease, and both breast and prostate cancers.
Well, that was depressing.
So when it comes to today's topic, colon cancer is clearly a case study, and we can round out our discussion by touching on some of these other afflictions. It's pretty well known that much of the mortality associated with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome can be ascribed to excessive food consumption and consequent obesity. And just an FYI, metabolic syndrome is just a simple term used to describe a collection of factors that can increase someone's risk of heart disease.
What hasn't been very widely recognized until recently is that fiber deficiency plays perhaps the most important role in the development of chronic inflammatory conditions and colon cancer because our microbiomes actually need sufficient fiber to function properly.
So, to break that down for you, not consuming enough fiber is the biggest cause of inflammatory conditions such as Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome, and colon cancer. Maybe you have some friends that can't consume certain things when you go out to eat, most commonly gluten. That may be because they have one of these inflammatory conditions. Shout out to you, Aubrey, and your gluten-free glory.
Ugh, gee, thanks for that, Dee. Though I suppose it might as well be common knowledge that my stomach and I hate each other.
Well, how do we know that eating less fiber and consuming a Western diet high in fat and red meat causes these diseases?
Well, I mean, the link has been suggested by studies we've touched on today, which demonstrate that these diseases aren't common in elderly members of less affluent societies. These individuals are significantly less likely to have adopted a Western diet, since the transition to this consumption pattern in less affluent societies happened more rapidly with younger generations through globalization.
Right. And recent studies of high-risk westernized human volunteers provide evidence that changing to a fiber-rich diet modifies a person's microbiome in such a way that metabolite production is induced. And these particular metabolites improve colonic mucosal health and suppress biomarkers of colon cancer risk within just 2 weeks.
Basically, this means that if you replace your fat-rich diet with a fiber-rich diet, then your risk of developing colon cancer will decrease substantially, potentially even within a very short period of time.
And adding to this, it's also been observed that it takes only one generation of westernization to increase cancer incidence in migrants.
So this, taken together with the estimation that more than 90% of colon cancer cases can be attributed to diet, provides a compelling argument for increasing the intake of fiber-rich foods in westernized populations.
I swear every time we have these foodie episodes, I walk away rethinking all of my daily life choices.
Good, that's the point. Hopefully our audience feels the same way.
Well, why don't we wrap up and let them tell us for themselves? Did this episode help you understand the effects of your daily dietary patterns? Have we sufficiently scared you?
Okay, now we didn't want to do that.
How do you think we can essentially undo the westernization of dietary patterns as the number of populations likely to adopt such a diet increases?
Do you think that labeling strategies, taxing strategies, or other evidence-based national action is feasible for government implementation? And more importantly, would they have any effect at all on the public's food choices?
Let us know by reaching out on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPforum or on Twitter by using the hashtag ISGPforum.
As always, we're grateful for your continuous support and would like to thank you for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.